Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a terrific show for you. Our guest live on the telephone lines with us will be Greg Palast, the renowned investigative journalist, talking about a lot of his new investigations and which are compiled in his new book and some of his writings that have come out since the new book has come out. I think it's a show you're really going to enjoy. A lot of path-breaking journalism and a tremendous critique of existing news media. So join us today on Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The clock is ticking on the demise of internet radio, and it looks like only Congress can stop it from happening. Here is the state of play. Earlier this year, the Copyright Royalty Board, an arm of the Library of Congress, set royalty rates for webcasters for the next 5 years. These rates were pretty much written by the major label music industry, which erroneously asserts that streaming audio equates to file sharing. Thus, the new rates are extremely high and require webcasters to pay for every song they stream to every listener. The expected cost is so big that all but the largest media companies simply won't be able to afford to pay them. That means the end of thousands of internet radio stations, some of whom have already signaled their intent to go off the air once the new rates take effect on July 15th. Late last month, two members of the House of Representatives introduced the Internet Radio Equality Act. The bill would require the Copyright Royalty Board to revise its royalty rate structure to make it affordable for all webcasters to remain online. It would essentially copy over the rate structure used right now by satellite radio service providers, though it would also carve out a separate rate for non-commercial webcasters. The problem is there's a question of whether Congress can move that quickly to stave off the beginning of a financial meltdown among internet radio stations due to the CRB's current draconian royalty rate structure. You can learn more about this issue and the Internet Radio Equality Act by visiting www.freepress.net/netradio. There you can read about the proposed legislation and sign a petition to your members of Congress urging them to step in before the July 15th deadline.
Will FCC Commissioner Deborah Taylor Tate literally become a puppet for Clear Channel Communications? The Center for Public Integrity has uncovered a list of talking points written for Commissioner Tate by a vice president of Clear Channel to be used when speaking about the proposed merger of the Sirius and XM satellite radio networks. Clear Channel and the National Association of Broadcasters strongly oppose a merger, and while Tate, to date, has no stated position on the deal, Clear Channel's helpfully written her three responses to Parrot if she decides to come out against it. The talking points are written in the first person. All she has to do is memorize them. Neither Clear Channel nor Tate herself will comment on the discovery.
Happy birthday to the Save the Internet Coalition. It was 1 year ago this spring that the grassroots campaign to preserve network neutrality online was launched. Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu, who coined the simple yet contentious term net neutrality to describe the fundamental principle of equal access to all free internet content, says the effort to restore the principle as a point of telecommunications law represents a sea change in the way such policy is crafted in Washington, D.C.
I think the plan was to sort of quietly bulldoze through telecom legislation last year to disable the FCC's oversight of net neutrality and just sort of let things go. It was a shock for everyone involved, the strength of the reaction. And so I think net neutrality and this campaign in general have changed the politics of telecom, maybe forever.
Since the founding of the SaveTheInternet.com website, which has been a nexus of organizing around the network neutrality issue, more than 1.6 million people have signed a petition to Congress asking it to prohibit phone and cable companies from becoming de facto content gatekeepers to the online world. The Christian Coalition of America, a Save the Internet Coalition partner, continues to educate and mobilize its members in all 50 states toward this goal, according to spokeswoman Michelle Combs, though she would like to see the issue debated more widely.
We'd really like for this issue to be a part of the presidential campaign on the Republican and the Democratic side. It's number two on our legislative agenda.
To that effect, one bill is pending in the Senate that would return network neutrality to its rightful place in telecom law. The Internet Freedom Preservation Act, introduced by Senators Byron Dorgan of North Dakota and Olympia Snow of Maine, currently only has 9 co-sponsors, though Senator Dorgan expects that number to rise in the near future.
I believe that we're developing a consensus here in the Senate, and I'm looking forward to being successful.
A companion bill should be introduced in the House sometime this summer. In related news, Save the Internet was just awarded 2 People's Voice Webby Awards in the categories of Best Activism Website and Best Public Service Video. Ironically, the People's Voice Awards are wholly sponsored by phone giant Verizon, one of the companies leading the corporate campaign to kill Internet freedom once and for all. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you live May 6, 2007. It's a pleasure to be here. Today we have as our guest someone that I've been looking forward to for a long time, who's been a guest on the program a couple times before, and is probably one of the most popular guests we've had on the show. Our guest is Greg Pallas, noted investigative journalist who's been covering a lot of breaking news stories. In fact, he's almost monopolizing a lot of them. I know he doesn't want to have a monopoly on it, but unfortunately he does. Greg is the author of 2 books, most recently the new paperback edition, which has new material in it, to his New York Times bestseller, Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild, in capital letters, no less. Greg Pallas, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, glad to be back with you, Bob. Yeah, like you say, the reluctant monopolist of investigative reports in the U.S.
You know, one story you don't have a monopoly on, and we're about to get to a bunch where you do, regrettably, is the prosecutor firings.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, I have some of the stuff. Let's put it this way. Carl wrote, you know, the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate under John Conyers, the chairman, subpoenaed all of the emails regarding the prosecutors from Karl Rove and the Rove bots, and among them are several that they've subpoenaed, which are screeds about that British reporter, Greg Pallas. And for those who don't know me, I report for BBC Television, and again, that's kind of reluctant because I can't get, you know, I'm obviously Mr. Rove. I'm not British. I'm an American. I mean, maybe Rove is un-American, but that's a whole different matter. But I'm quite American. It's just that my reports are exiled. The only way I can report them is from BBC. So he's gloating that no one's picking up the first he's complaining about my reports for BBC, and then he was gloating on a February 7th email, confidential one, that and his minions, that no one in the U.S. media has picked up my reports in the book Armed Madhouse. And he actually included a PDF excerpt of the book, which was probably my favorite review of all, you know. Well, the good part of it is Karl Rove, like, going ballistic over the book. The bad part is that he is probably correct that there is no U.S. media, national media, which will touch this stuff, which, and bless you, Bob, for kind of, you know, breaking the official omerta here.
Well, on the prosecutor firings case, is there... What do you think is yet to be demonstrated that's out there? What is missing in the story?
Well,
right now?
The most important thing in my there's 2 things that they were screaming about in our Madhouse. One is the most important. Everyone's talked about who's been fired. No one's really talking about who's been hired, who the replacements are. I mean, at most you get like loyal. Oh, they replaced these people, the resistors with loyal bushies is the phrase. It's worse than that. Okay, in Armed Madhouse, I have a story of, which also, again, never covered in the U.S. media, top of the BBC Nightly News, front page of the British papers, is that before the 2004 election, Karl Rove directed a program of challenging literally hundreds of thousands of African-American and Hispanic voters. And now, you know, people may remember my story of 2000 where Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris knocked off, you know, targeted 97,000 voters as felons who weren't eligible voters, you know, illegally voting, illegally registered. And they purged those from the voter rolls. But, of course, their only crime, as it turned out, was voting while black. And not some of them, by the way. We don't have a single prosecution of an illegal voter there, even though those lists have been combed like crazy. 97,000, not one illegal voter, not one. That was the 2000 election. But it happened again. Finally, the press took, in the case of the New York Times, 4 years to report that story. But we had another one in 2004. It was even worse. But they were targeting people on the basis of so-called suspect addresses. You know what the main suspect address was, Bob?
Yep. What was it?
Baghdad. What happened was they were targeting African-American and Hispanic soldiers sent overseas. What they were you'll love this one. They were sending letters. The Rove bots were sending tens of thousands of letters to soldiers and registered from their home addresses. Do not forward. When the letters came back as undelivered, not surprisingly, they challenged the right of these voters to vote. And that meant when voters, like we had one, Randall Prousey, sent in his absentee ballot using his home address. I mean, you know, he's overseas, using his home address. And it was challenged by the Republican Party and chucked away. He didn't even know his vote was challenged. You know, go to Baghdad, lose your vote. It is, by the way, and what's important about this, one, what's important from Media Matters is that this was the top of the nightly news at BBC that I reported. It was absolutely zero nowhere in America, except for one little story in the LA Times where they said, oh, critics of Bush accused them of challenging Republicans of challenging voters. No, not critics of Bush, BBC investigation. You know, so it's like on one hand this and the other hand that. The main thing, what Rove was very concerned about and what they're gloating about, the R. Madhouse story not being picked up because it's in the book, is that Rove wasn't in charge of this himself. He put a guy named Tim Griffin in charge of this action. And Griffin is now U.S. prosecutor for Arkansas. So when they fired Bob Cummins, who was, in the scheme of things, relatively honest, they replaced him with this guy Griffin, who did the wipeout of the black voters. Now, what's significant about that? In two things, not only as I've been working with voting rights attorney Bobby Kennedy Jr., and as he points out, this is not creepy. It's not just racist. You know, something that Rove and his minions might be doing while they are wearing white hoods. It's against the law. You cannot target people where race is a factor in your decision, and of course, you cannot target voters whom you know are legal voters. So you got like a double crime here. It's a felony count, the violation of the Voting Rights Act of 65. And so you have a perpetrator of a crime becoming the prosecutor. Perpetrator becomes the prosecutor, and that's mission accomplished. They're really happy that while the rest of the world knows this story, in the U.S., forget it. It doesn't exist.
Our guest is Greg Palast. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Greg Palast, author of the brand new version, the paperback version, with a lot of new material, to his New York Times bestseller, Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. We're talking about that book, some of the investigative stories Greg has been breaking for BBC and the English press, much of which has not gotten much play in the United States. If you have any questions or comments for Greg Palast, the telephone number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. One of the columns you wrote recently, Greg Palast, mm-hmm. just about a week ago on your website, gregpalast.com, talks about the media lapdogs not digging deep. And every time I read one of your stories or I'm reading your book, invariably what's implicit there is an extraordinary critique of the U.S. news media.
Yeah, I mean, every one of my stories is double. One is what I call a story in chief, you know. They challenged literally hundreds of thousands of black soldiers and homeless men and students. Yeah, that's how they fixed the election. I mean, not just in Ohio and elsewhere. That was part of it. How they're intending to fix 08. The second is it's non-coverage in the U.S. press. I mean, So there's always the story about the story, and in the U.S., it's that it don't get covered. Now, again, it's not like I'm coming from some strange, that this material is hidden under some in some strange blog somewhere. In fact, by the way, that the complaint I wrote, the L.A. Times allowed me to actually complain about the mainstream press because they were the one paper that, in fact, at least mentioned the Caging List story. That is, Caging Lists were the name of it's what they called the thousands and thousands of black soldiers and others that they were challenging. They called them when they made the list. They called them Caging Lists. And but basically, it's just not covered. You can't, and you can, and by the way, it's not like lack of trying. You have to understand, like, ABC News is a sister state, has a film trading agreement with BBC, my network. And Bobby Kennedy actually called the head of ABC News and said, why aren't you putting this on the air? I mean, this is amazing. You're talking about a criminal, a guy who's run a criminal conspiracy to fix the election, Tim Griffin, working under Karl Rove. And he's now the U.S. prosecutor. Why isn't this part of the news that's being covered?
What did they tell him?
And so they said, to get Bobby off their back, they called me up and basically said, oh, we'll be happy to run your reports, Greg. Never, ever, ever. and in fact, they have never once taken a BBC report, Newsnight report, which is their right to take. Not once, ever. And so that's one of the reasons, for example, I basically hand them over no charge to Amy Goodman, so at least we can, and Democracy Now!, so at least we can kind of sneak them, you know, sneak them around the electronic Berlin Wall there. But so and they can't plead ignorance of the stories.
Now, Greg, let me ask you. I know a lot of the people who work at the commercial news media and PBS and NPR, for that matter, are not card-carrying Republicans. They're not huge fans necessarily of President Bush or Karl Rove, for that matter. Yet there seems to be a stone wall there. I mean, am I wrong? Are these all
they're
Republican
actually
partisans?
I would consider NPR the worst, National Petroleum Radio. I'll get something on normal on the mainstream airwaves once in a while. Like the LA Times picked up the Caging story, but NPR won't. And in fact, that phrase "we'll let on Greg Palast never, ever, ever" is from an NPR producer. Again,
but my point is,
have you ever? Yeah, but have you ever? Here's a question: have you ever found a story? First of all, has NPR broken a single story in the last two decades? One, none is the answer, of course, which you know. In fact, if it ain't in the New York Times and it ain't in the Washington Post, it isn't going to be read on the air by NPR. Basically, they are readers, not reporters. They're repeaters, not reporters. That's what they do. And so they say, we are very courageous. We would never censor a report that we've read that morning in the New York Times that we're repeating.
But again, Greg, let me ask you this question, you know, because even at ABC, I know a lot of people in the commercial news media, they aren't all hardcore George W. Bush fans.
Yeah.
There must be some people there who would say, hey, this looks like a really good story.
Lots do.
What
they
happens
lose their
to
them? Jobs. I mean, I was just on... I was just talking last night with Bree Walker, who is the news anchor for CBS in Los Angeles. She's paid more than $1 million a year. Said if I, you know, said there goes my $1 million a year job if I try to report an original story. And she finally got fed up and quit. I mean, that was a hell of a piece of change to walk away from. But you know, a lot of people just said enough is enough. I mean, obviously, you well know Danny Schechter used to be with 2020. You know, there is no original news anymore. If it ain't coming from a press release, even the prosecutor's story, which they're finally getting on, after all, prosecutors, number one, were fired last year, got no coverage. It was only when John Conyers opened hearings. In other words, they have the courage to report on stories where they don't have to take a position, like controversy. Like I said, the L.A. Times did report my story, but decided to pretend that there was a controversy. You know, it's not reporting fact. The fact was that Karl Rove challenged illegally tens of thousands of black soldiers' right to vote, period. It's not a controversy. It's not an allegation. It's a fact, okay? And so to cover themselves, it's like critics of Bush allege. Well, I'm not a critic of Bush. I'm a critic of all of them. I'm an investigator of Bush and all of them. And then they say, and it was placed on BBC. Well, no, BBC, first of all, we investigated. It's something, can you name an investigative original from, you know, look in the documents, get the stuff report from that's on U.S. national TV or radio media. I can't think of one instance of a major story broken that way. It's all controversy. You know, so Conyers Committee alleges that prosecutors were fired for political reasons. They'll cover that controversy. Democrats say, Republicans deny. Republicans accuse, Democrats deny. No original reporting going on. It just ain't happening.
Greg Palast, our guest, and before we go to our phone lines, I do want to follow up on this point because you are not a partisan. I don't think it'd be fair to have it presented as you're carrying water.
If you go to Triple W Greg Palast right now, you will find a story that Hillary Clinton deeply does not want told.
Yes, and I was going to ask you about that. You read my mind. What is that story?
Well, I mean, that one, it's a bit older because it's from research I did for the Guardian papers. And very interestingly, by the way, a lot of feminists were very, very unhappy when I first began breaking stories about Hillary Clinton when she was still the golden girl, you know, the lady bearing the standard. Now they're thrilled to take a piece of her because the charm, the glow is worn off. But, you know, that story is really about Hillary's addiction to conflicts of interest where she can pick up some change. I mean, you know, and burial of that information. I mean, look, I mean, you can hear from her about her six months on the Child Welfare Task Force, but nothing about the 6 years on her board, on the board of directors and lawyer flack catcher for Walmart Corporation, Sam Walton's little lady, as he called her. And even worse, of course, is there was clearly the evidence is pretty irrefutable that I was able to discover that the payments, basically payoffs, were made to keep people silent about her manipulation of billing records, apparent manipulation of billing records at the Rose Law Firm. A lot of lawyers overbill, but if you get caught, you go to prison. And that cost a pretty piece of change to keep quiet. One guy even was paid off to agree to go to jail and keep quiet. And, you know, it's not a pleasant story, but that's how it works.
Our guest,
and by the way, Bill Clinton had his happy little hands in there. I know that some people would like to think of him as heroic, and maybe he did some heroic things, but you know, I have to report it. It was very difficult, by the way, to report that story. You know, a lot of people just didn't want to hear it.
Our guest, Greg Palast. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so the phone lines are open at 1-800-222-9455 or our local number, 333-9455. Greg Palast, author of the new paperback edition, new and improved, I might add, paperback edition of Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. Let's go to our phone lines now. Line 4, Spring Bay, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Greg Palast. I think line 4, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, you're on the air with Greg Palast.
This is an ugly question, but
okay.
I've heard some innuendos that Karl Rove is maybe in the closet, and just wondered if you had picked up anything on that. And the reason I would ask such a question is I could care less one way or the other, but when someone's in that kind of position of policy, all of that, if they're living a deceit, I think that could come, you know, and have bad policy implications somewhere down the line. So.
Well, two things I would tell you is that, for example, in Britain, I had that information on two very, very important politicians, and I refused to report it. That's just one thing I won't, unless there is a very, very clear public policy reason. I was asked by my editors to out these guys, and I just simply refused. And I wouldn't do the same with Rove, because I think also because it's not that he's in the closet; it's that he's in the bat cave there. You know, I mean, that's the big problem, is that the guy is sitting there, you know, caging like animals African American voters, and using a guy Tim Griffin as the hitman, and that story needs to be reported. That's a go to jail offense, and then let him work out his private interests behind bars. That'll then be his business and his problem. That's what I'm concerned with. I'm concerned with, there are other aspects, by the way, of that prosecutor case that are also in our madhouse. Again, because the U.S. media would only pick it up once Conyers said, here's a problem, they'll cover the controversy and the accusation from an official source, a congressman, a chairman. But in the book, I'm actually talking two years ago with David Iglesias in his office, one of the fired prosecutors, who's indicating that basically he was calling the Roverians a bunch of liars. And, of course, for neither his, you know, unfortunately, he didn't realize that one of my more avid readers is Karl Rove, with his kind of blood-stained highlighter, who, you know, saw that in my book that Iglesias is being disloyal, and he was the last name added to the executioner's list, because he would not go along. By the way, what Rove wanted him to do was, and I now have even more information as of a couple days ago, here, Bob McChesney first, breaking story, I'll give it to you, which is that...
another one.
Which is that, yes, indeed, that there were direct calls made to David Iglesias. He wasn't fired because he didn't bring a prosecution against a Democrat named Manny Aragon. That's almost the cover story. Manny, everyone in New Mexico knows that Manny is one of the most corrupt politicians to walk the Georgia O'Keeffe plateau. So there was it was like a non-shock that he was finally handcuffed, and that Iglesias was just waiting for the full panoply of evidence to gather. He was fired because he was told, he refused, as I found out 2 years ago, he refused to bring prosecutions against voters for voter fraud. Remember, they're knocking off tens of thousands of voters, these characters. The Rove characters are literally challenging legal voters. They're covering themselves and trying to create a hysteria to create voter ID laws, which will knock out more voters, by claiming that illegal Mexicans are voting or that they're voting twice. And Iglesias simply said, refused to go along with it. And they told him, when he said, I have no evidence here, you're not giving me evidence, you're giving me names of two guys named Juan Gonzalez are voting in New Mexico, or a guy named Juan Gonzalez is voting twice. And it's like pretty clear that there's just two guys named Juan Gonzalez in New Mexico. He wouldn't prosecute these guys, and they called him and said, charge him anyway. You know, big deal. So you take a couple of Chicanos and you put some cuffs on them. Everyone knows they're guilty. You know, he wouldn't do it. Partly, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, despite being an Ashcroft protege, his own personal background placed a limit on it. There's a certain line in the desert sand, and you know, unfortunately for him, he kind of hinted that to me, and his people would not go along with the game, and so he got nailed. So the information is, he got direct calls told, prosecute anyway. I mean, you have to understand, this is a conspiracy. This is obstruction of justice. Go to jail, another go to jail crime. And I know who made the calls. That I'm not going to release right at this minute.
Greg Pallas, with the information you're just revealing now, with the reporting you've done on the Bush administration, not just on the prosecutor firings and the elections with Karl Rove, but also with the Iraq War and a number of other issues, you know, a lot of my guests have been talking in the past year about the question or issue of impeachment. And with regard to this issue, it seems like the news media is basically saying, unless the Democrats raise it, we don't really care what the facts are, we're ignoring it. And most Democrats are saying, unless the news media make the case, we're certainly not going to jump out in front of it because we know we'll get flame broiled by the news media. So now, regardless of what the facts are, no one's willing to raise this issue. What's your take on the impeachment question?
Well, of course, impeachment, like as a journalist, I don't per se have a thought on impeachment. The question is, is there impeachable material which hasn't been reported? And that's what I've been concerned with. I mean, and I talk about that in our madhouse. And I actually wrote a piece in a book called The Impeachment of the President. What I'm concerned with is getting that information out. In fact, that's probably the value of an impeachment process, whether you're for or against this, is that we're going to now subpoena these records and start going through them. And it won't be about a green dress. I mean, this is serious stuff. This is about lying about a war. I did not find, but I brought over to the U.S. what's now called the Downing Street memo, where the facts were fixed to the intelligence. That's a fraud upon the public. That's an impeachable offense. I even titled it the Downing Street memo piece I wrote, Impeachment Time. And so it's not a matter of the discussion of impeachment. It's the facts that lead to impeachment which have been covered over. You know, when the Downing Street memo was broken, out. The New York Times ran a news analysis saying, "Well, it's not the Rosetta Stone. We've run this stuff about the doubts." No, it's not about doubts. It's about a deliberate fraud. Fixing the facts talks about deliberate fraud. And one of the stories I ran about Iraq, for example, you know, they're constantly saying oil has nothing to do with it, despite calling it originally Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. On the top of the BBC Nightly News, after a year and a half of investigation, by the way, we were able to uncover the original documents for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, by the way, the Dick Cheney meetings in March of 2001 were part of that discussion. I now know who participated and what they're up to. Now, you would think that would be in the U.S. papers. It was the front page of The Guardian. It was the top of the nightly news in Britain. And when I say BBC, I mean that you have to understand that is the number one news English language news network worldwide. That is the prime source, the premier network. So, and what that means is it's almost impossible for them to claim, the U.S. networks, that they don't know these stories. But again, unless you have a Democrat standing up and, you know, a committee chairman saying we're investigating and they can cover that controversy, they ain't going to cover the facts. And, you know, it just drives me crazy, Bob. that I have to report from overseas.
Our guest, Greg Palast, author of the new paperback version just released with new material. Armed Madhouse is the title of the book, a New York Times bestseller. Greg is joining us on the phone. We do have phone lines open here at WILL AM 580. The number again is 1-800-222-9455. Our local number 333-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line one. Indiana, you're on the air with Greg Palast.
Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen. Greg, how you doing?
Okay.
Hey, I was wondering, what's your take? I first became aware of you through Doug Basham in Las Vegas. You remember him?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Another guy who broke through the electronic Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
Lost his job.
I began to first realize, are you living in the United States or in England now?
A little of each, but yeah, mostly back in the U.S., because I intend to, whether Rove likes it or not, I am trying to get the attention of the U.S. media.
Yeah, because I heard there were some repercussions with you here or something, and that's something I have a need. You and I have got to talk. Those of us that have been in federal law enforcement or journalistic positions know. The question I had was why, and what's your take on the reason why we're not too exposing the North American Union and also Jesuit control of all world situations in this country? What's your take on that? And I guess I'll have to hang up, I hear, and I'll talk to you soon, Greg, through your New York office.
Okay.
And I'll just wait on the air.
Okay. Yeah,
thank you very much, caller. Now, maybe you give a little background, Greg, because
okay.
I think a lot of our listeners might not be familiar with this.
All right. Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, I'm an investigative reporter, so my rule is if I ain't investigated it, I ain't reporting on it. And I don't know anything about this Jesuit story. I mean, it may be interesting. I literally don't know what it's about.
So I don't
either. I hate to even comment on a story I don't know anything about.
That's fair enough. Let's go to our phone lines again then. Let's go to line two, Champaign County. You're on the air with Greg Palast.
I'm still recovering from Jesuit control here. I wanted to ask about the Wisconsin part of the attorney scandal. There are so many scandals, and I think this is a huge one, but there's so many other indignities and war crimes that we can talk about with the DOJ. But I still, putting that aside, and, you know, I think this should still be focused on, the one in Wisconsin, and both of the senators from Wisconsin asked about it, is this idea that a low-level Democratic operative was prosecuted, convicted, but when it came to appeal after the election, it was completely laughed out of court. And Bakusip, I guess is his name, was on the list and then off the list. And it looks totally like it was put up as an electoral campaign. I even heard an ad that used the example of the corruption. And it
right.
As I say, it was insubstantial, wasn't a lot of money. It didn't really go to anybody close to the governor of Wisconsin.
Let me, if I could step
ahead,
in just
please.
To clarify for the listeners who don't know. We've talked, I just told you about the Republican prosecutor Iglesias in New Mexico, who refused to bring a false prosecution and lost his job. There was a prosecutor in Wisconsin who was about to lose his job. They put his neck in the guillotine, and basically, suddenly, he does bring a prosecution where judges just went wild. They did everything but throw a gavel at his head, saying that the evidence for bringing this case was below thin, is the words of a judge. Now, you have to understand, when a judge says something like that, he's basically saying, this is prosecutorial misconduct. This is one, you know, the greatest fear is when our government turns on us and when they use the power of prosecution. That's a whole, that was the number one thing, the reason for grand juries, all these protections, public juries, everything is set to make sure that the government doesn't do a Soviet-style prosecution of them they don't like, but that's exactly what these guys are doing. In the case of Wisconsin, there was a prosecutor who you know, just grabbed his ankles and said, I'd rather keep my job than keep my soul, and he brought a false prosecution against a low-level Democratic operative, a fake thing about, favoritism and contracts, and it was just a complete phony fabrication, nonsense, baloney, evil. But he gave, obviously, the Rove bots exactly what they wanted, and he saved his job. That is a deep evil, but we're only at the beginning of this, see, because it's, that's why I say they haven't really dropped the big ones, which is who they're putting in. Where they really are, I mean, again, I'm quoting Bobby Kennedy, which says you got, these people should not be in office, they should be in prison, who are prosecutors. So, you have this, like, it's like a mob coup d'etat within the Justice Department. But there are things cracking open. I mean, I did just, I've done another story, by the way, on how George Bush's cronies, or his funders, I don't know if you call them cronies, they're funders of the Republican Party, have been figure out a way to waylay and pocket for themselves the debt relief meant for Africa and for African AIDS money. I mean, it's such a horrific, complex story. Again, very, very big in Britain when I did it. Nothing here. And, we just cannot get the, I don't know what we do, Bob, except what do we do, Bob? Maybe someone has a solution here.
Well, I recall in 2000 the famous story when you broke the story of in Florida, how African-American voters are being denied the franchise, and then you gave it to CBS, and CBS called Governor Jeb Bush's office and said, is there anything to it? He said no. So they said, okay, then we're not going to run the story.
Yeah. I mean, you have to understand what Bob just said. CBS was going to run the BBC story, and then they called up. They said, it doesn't stand up, and I said, why? And they said, well, we called Jeb Bush, and he said it wasn't true. Oh, and in that case, they wouldn't even run the stories like, we said, he said. It was like, well, Bush said it's not true, so it's not true.
Our guest is Craig Pallas today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Greg, you have a international following, as does, thanks to the Internet, this program. Our next caller on line four is calling from London, England. London, you're on the air with Greg Pallas.
Hi, Greg Pallas. How wonderful to talk to you. Quickly, I'm curious what newspapers you write for over here, because I haven't been able to find you. But more important, I've been investigating for months now a story about babies being stolen by the social services. And these senior workers, they lie in court and do all sorts of devious things to actually steal babies. Two of the workers, senior workers on the case I've been investigating, turned out to be American, and I have reason to think there might even be some kind of government or CIA connections. And so I'm wondering, how can I get this story out? Where can I go?
Okay, a couple of things. Number one, if watch BBC Newsnight, you would probably, Britain's known as Jeremy Paxman's program, even though it's associated with me here in the U.S. He's the main anchor. And that's BBC Newsnight, which, by the way, you can get on the Internet in the U.S., and I recommend it. The other is I had a column in the Observer, the Sunday Observer, which is a Sunday paper of The Guardian, and write regularly for The Guardian. But because I've been so inundated with Armed Madhouse and trying to get this out, I've had very little chance to write for The Guardian at this point. Of course, there, and I wish to apologize to my editors who are listening. Yeah, I'll get back to it. But, you know, that's the problem is that if I, you know, I'd love to write, I love writing for The Guardian, but, you know, I'm an American. I don't want my stuff to be drowned trying to cross the Atlantic. And that's is a very, very, personally for me, it's very, very difficult. I don't know about the child, the baby story. You know, I'll put it on the list or something to take a look at.
Greg, if I can go before we go back to the phone calls, I do want to follow up on one story. I don't know if you remember this, but the very first time you were on Media Matters 5 years ago was the day of the Venezuelan coup ending and Chavez returning to power.
Yes.
And we sort of that was the first story we ever broke in Media Matters. Today we had the second. And you've still followed Venezuela, I think, over the years. What is your take on what's going on in Venezuela today? What would you say most Americans are missing from their news coverage of Venezuela?
Venezuela is what they're missing. There's a chapter in our madhouse, by the way, called The Assassination of Hugo Chavez, where I'm joking with Chavez, who has a great sense of humor, about his coming assassination. Oh, excuse me. He believes he's a good chess player who can get around it. What we're not getting is we're not getting anything close to the real story. Why are they picking? Why is this guy being singled out as opposed to our friends like Nazarbayev, the bloodthirsty dictator in Kazakhstan? The answer is that it's the OIL, it's the oil. Hugo Chavez is sitting on, according to the information I put in the book, and I did on BBC, from Venezuela. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, Venezuela, not Saudi Arabia, has the world's largest reserves of oil. And that is deeply, deeply disturbing to the United States, which is, I shouldn't say the United States, I should say the Bush, House of Bush, which is very close to the House of Saud. And so they do not like Chavez's quiet but insistent challenge to the hegemony of Saudi Arabia within the OPEC cartel. This is a war over oil. And they are really concerned with Chavez's desire to stabilize the price of oil, even if it's lower than it is today. As of Friday, the price of oil was $64 a barrel. When I was with Chavez, he said, look, I want to sell you oil at 50. Now, that, when he talked, it was like 75. I mean, he's talking about a major discount, which he started, of course, for low-income areas in the United States. If we can stabilize the price of oil, Bill Clinton had a handshake deal with him, which held. The price of oil was between 20 to 25 bucks a barrel under Bill Clinton. Now it hasn't gone below 50 bucks a barrel, which is the Chavez offer. Now, why in the world would George Bush, our president, turn down an offer from a guy to give us cheap, stable supply of oil? And there's, like I say, more than Saudi Arabia. So there's a lot of it. It's relatively cheap, not too cheap. Why reject it? And you have to go back to the fact that what we have in the White House is an unelected crew of oil patch babies. When they look at the change in the price of oil from 20 bucks a barrel to $64 a barrel, as far as they're concerned and the people behind them are concerned, it's mission accomplished. And if you think I'm kidding, again, you have to look at those secret plans for the oil fields of Iraq. It's all about not getting you oil cheaply, but making sure that the price of oil stays high by limiting the flow of oil. They were not concerned that Saddam would cut off our oil supply. In fact, he wanted to sell more. We were limiting him under the oil for food program. You know, very little food for them, very little oil for us. And there was always a fear he would produce more. We had to stop him from producing more, not from cutting us off. That's the big fear. And now they've started this hysteria now that Chavez is a dictator. You know, this guy is unbelievably popular down there. I went down there. I spent a lot of time with his opposition, too, and some of them I really like. They're very, very intelligent, nice, sincere people. I don't want to, you know, a lot of people know me as the so-called close friend of Chavez. We get along extremely well, but I'm friendly with his opposition, too. The thing is that he's got the votes. I went to one town where I found one person. I was with the presidential opposition candidate. We found one supporter of this guy, and we had lunch with her, and it was very nice. And then I went the next day to the same exact town with Hugo Chavez. There were 2,000, 3,000 screaming supporters. It was like you thought Elvis had come to town. And we have a government which is trying to destabilize and eliminate, if not assassinate, an elected president, so they have to pretend that he's not elected. He's some type of dictator, unlike the, you know, the New York Times. I love this. The New York Times finally got an interview with Chavez, and you know what they asked him? They asked him, when are you going to give up power? This is the elected president. Did the New York Times ever ask George Bush, when are you going to, the unelected president, when are you going to give up power? Can you imagine?
Our guest, Greg Palast, today on Media Matters. He's the author of the new book, Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. It's the paperback version of his New York Times bestseller with new material specifically on the 2008 election, what's coming up. Greg, we have a full bank of people waiting to speak to you. I'm going to ask them to be as brief as possible so we can make sure all four callers have an opportunity to talk to you. Let's start right now with line three on a cell phone from the roads of Illinois. You're on with Greg Palast.
Well, I don't have too much to say about it, except I think all this is the biggest bunch of crap I've ever heard in my life.
Okay.
You know, I just, it's just crap. What you're saying is just all crap.
Okay. Well, what if it is? I mean, See, the point of Armed Madhouse, the advantage of writing a book is that I can actually show the documents, which is one thing, again, I'm allowed to do on BBC television, is actually give you the documents. Whether you like my analysis or my views, well, you know, it might all be crap. You might be dead right. Who am I to say? But what I'd like you to do is read the book and look at the documents, and you make a decision about what they mean. The caging list of the voters, the secret documents for the oil fields of Iraq, and the material, like in the new book, I have a whole lot of material on what they didn't tell you about the drowning of the city of New Orleans. You look at the documents, you look at the material, you know, take it any way you want. I mean, I throw my view on it. It's very British to, you know, that you should say what your view is. But you might have a different view, think I'm crap, but why can't we get this on U.S. TV or in U.S. papers, the information, the documents, the stuff, the hard stuff? That's my complaint.
Well, you know, you talk about the BBC, that's the most anti-American left-wing press in the world. They hate us, and the Guardian's the same way. I mean, I read their crap, and it's, like I said, it's all crap. There's really no proof of anything you've had to say. I mean, you say the documents and so forth. Well, what is that, the same documents that you, that George Bush National Guard thing on CBS? Well, that was a big lie, too.
Well, actually, come to think, you brought up a good example. All Dan Rather did was repeat a story that I reported on BBC a year earlier. You should understand that BBC, unlike CBS, has never retracted a comma, a syllable of my report, which is in our madhouse. In fact, we go further to keep silent the fact that Daddy Bush got Baby Bush out of the war in Vietnam. We reported on the massive payments made to maintain the silence of those who did the fix. That's a very heavy accusation. And we, by the way, we have never, in BBC, it's not like we'd be unnoticed, we have never received a denial from the White House about the fix, nor have we received a denial from the White House about the payoffs. And we are not retracting the story, and we have the documentation. In fact, I show it right in the book. Again, when you get the documentation, see, in CBS, they used this, like, sideways memo, which had nothing to do with anything, nothing to do with the draft dodging. It was like this goofy sideways thing, which was a mistake for them to use. But the story in chief comes from our reporting at BBC. We've got the documents. You look at the documents in our madhouse. It's in the section called the lynching of Dan Rather. And by the way, I offered CBS $100,000 if they could provide to BBC the evidence that we were wrong. Because we'll be thrilled to retract the story if it's wrong. I don't mind, and we'll pay the $100,000. CBS has never produced that material.
I don't think you'd be happy with paying out the $100,000. I listen to both sides. I try to listen to both sides, and I've come down to the conclusion that the left is just absolutely nuts. They hate George Bush. They hate the Bush administration. And it's obvious too that the BBC is. Said it wouldn't produce a. I can't get that one right. But anyway, this whole notion that you know, that Karl Rove is some evil white man on the, you know, it just doesn't make sense. It's just a bunch of crap.
Actually, I should say Karl Rove is not an evil genius. I agree with you. The left think of him as an evil genius. They're only half right. He's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, because I have, you know, 500 of the emails that the Congress is looking for, where he and his minions used the RNC, the Republican Party computers. 500 of those emails were missent, and I have them. BBC has 500 of those missing emails, and that's some of the most. That is some of the most. I got to tell you, if that's, I used to be a racketeering investigator. This is the type of stuff that ends up people breaking rocks on a chain gang. You got to look at these things, man. They are just straight up talking about how you fix an election, and they have the cookbook right there in those emails. I don't care what your view is, your political view. You know, and it's difficult because I do a lot of this investigation of Democrats too, and I want to emphasize that just that the crew in power right now is just so extreme that obviously I got to fill up the book with mostly about those guys, because it's the information, the self-incriminating information that they've left around. It indicates, one, the deep nature of their manipulation of the powers of government, but it also indicates their great arrogance in leaving the information right out there, because they know if that British reporter, Greg Palast, reports it, the U.S. media ain't going to pick it up.
Greg Palast, let's go on to our next phone line if we can. Now we have another very patient caller. Line one, Farina, you're on the air with Greg Palast.
Hi. Thank you so much, Greg. And Bob, this show should be more than an hour long. Okay, I'll just run over a couple of topics. The spinning of the Tenet book. I want to plug Bill Moyer's journal. The show Friday night had a section about a book called Collusion, about the CIA lies about Iraq's acquisition or fake acquisition of uranium. Kucinich brought impeachment proceedings against Cheney, and it was seconded by, I'm proud to say, an Illinois representative. I just got to see the Enron movie, talk about manipulation. Explain how that's crap. Okay, yeah, I know. The other thing is, how do you remedy the loss of confidence in the voting system if all the election machines, if the perception is the election machines are being hacked? Okay, one last point, that George Bush has betrayed the American people. The Republicans should be shamed out of office. Period. They think we're stupid. They think we're lazy. They think we're ignorant. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. Let me go to the factual matters.
Greg, let me just ask you to pick one of those things so we can get to the other callers so that you think's most important to talk about.
Well, I would say that this issue of discouragement because they manipulate the voting system. I do have a section in the brand new edition of the book, just because a lot of people were getting discouraged by my reports of election finagling on a massive scale, is that I include a little section called Swipe Back Your Vote, which is practical ways that you can prevent these shenanigans. And there have been very successful movements. I write about the theft of the vote in New Mexico and the resistance of the Democratic governor, Bill Richardson, to reform the system. I mean, he didn't want to get John Kerry elected. He's running for president now. But once there was a kind of public uprising against the sickening manipulation of the vote in New Mexico, everyone talks about Ohio, New Mexico was worse. And he's now become a leader of the pro-reform movement. They've eliminated all the electronic and punch card voting. It's all paper ballot now in New Mexico. You know, it's just that he eliminated the draconian ID laws, which are basically knocking out Hispanic voters. I mean, you can make a difference. Plus, there's some real simple steps you can take. But just because it's difficult doesn't mean you should do it. I mean, Martin Luther King basically sacrificed his life. Bobby Kennedy's daddy sacrificed his life so that people can vote. If it's difficult, too bad. That's just, we'll have to live with that. Get over it.
Our guest is Greg Palast, author of the book Armed Madhouse. He's joining us on the phone. You're listening to WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We have time, we hope, for a couple more calls. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Virginia, the toll-free line. You're on the air with Greg Palast.
Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen. I think you can report because I'm doing very good work. Greg, I wanted to ask you something about the Venezuelan affair. Let's go back to Hugo Chavez, and if I don't know if you heard about this recent RCTV affair.
Yes.
I just wanted to know what your comment is about this this saying Hugo Chavez not renewing the license to RCTV. Could you please comment on that? What's going on in that?
Yeah, two things.
Give a little background, if you would, Greg, for listeners unfamiliar with the story.
Okay. In 2002, Hugo Chavez was kidnapped with the, if not the active intervention, at least with the applause of the Bush administration. He was literally kidnapped. And RCTV, which is the big TV network there, was deeply involved in this failed coup d'etat. Even in, you know, encouraging the coup leaders and their owner, obviously being involved in the coup planning. In addition, they blanked out the news of the uprising. And I talked to the I was at the station, by the way, and they admitted to me directly that they manipulated the news because, as far as they were concerned, Chavez was a monster, and anything that they could do to keep him out of office, if not kill him, was just fair game. I'm talking to their main news reporters and producers. Now, in the U.S., if any news station involved itself in planning the kidnapping of the President of the United States, they would, needless to say, they would lose their license. Chavez did not take away their license, but now he is talking about not renewing their license. I actually, despite what should be, in normal circumstances, I would say that when... when journalists involve themselves in criminal activity like that, that they really are no longer journalists, but simply criminals, and have no right to continue their work. However, in the case of Venezuela, I see no reason for the elimination of an opposition voice. Now, understand that the opposition owns all of the commercial networks. All Hugo Chavez has to respond is the state-owned network, but what the irony is that the state-owned network is now very popular, and his own TV show is the most popular on the air. No one would miss it. It's a lot of fun, singing, dancing. I've been on it, singing, dancing,
well,
and
Greg,
politics. But you know, so I would say I am very uncomfortable with the fact that Chavez has no right to feel threatened by the opposition TV station, and I wish he would not remove that license. I completely disagree with the decision of the government.
We've got about a minute left. Let's go to our final caller, line two on a cell phone. You're on the air with Greg Palast.
Yes, hi. Great show. I'm really appalled by the caller, actually, a little bit ago, who actually is still supporting Bush. I, for business purposes, I've traveled probably 8 months out of the year internationally, and I've never seen the U.S. at such, well, the world at such dangerous level where the Americans are directly being blamed for what's going on. Prior to the 2004 war elections, it was basically nobody knew what Bush was about, so it's fine. But after 2004, they said you guys deserve what's coming your way. So I'm concerned for my children, for my for the future generation, the way things are going with this administration and the war. And you have still phone callers like this who are blindly supportive of this situation, making it even more dangerous for us. I mean, look at the recently Wolfowitz story. It was every single day, internationally, day in, day out. And then, what do we talk about? We talk about the CBS sacking.
Okay, caller, I'm gonna thank you for calling. Now we've only got a few seconds left. Greg, do you have a final word you'd like to say before we go?
Yeah. Well, until Patriot Act 4 kicks into place, you can read our madhouse, though. And though I have to be very careful because I actually, as you'll read in the new edition of the book, I was actually charged with violating the anti-terror laws by the Department of Homeland Security while I was filming a story for Rarely.
Well,
I was
Greg,
actually filming
on that
BBC.
Note, my producers waved me off the air. I want to thank Greg Palast for being our guest today, author of Our Madhouse. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I'll be back 1 week from today. See you later.